As a therapist, I'm often asked why depression and anxiety are so common among children and adolescents. One explanation, almost surely the most neglected, is declining interest in God and religion. I see the consequences of this in my practice almost every day, and this is not merely my personal observation. A 2018 Harvard study involving 5,000 people examined how being raised in a family with religious beliefs affects the mental health of children. The study found that kids who attended a religious service at least once per week scored higher on psychological well-being measurements and had lower risks of mental illness. Weekly attendance was also associated with higher rates of volunteerism, lower probabilities of both drug use and early sexual initiation, and a sense of purpose. Yet despite all the evidence that religious involvement leads to positive behaviors, Gallup reports that the U.S. has seen a 20% decrease in attendance at formal religious services in the past 20 years. In 2018, the American Family Survey revealed that nearly half of adults under 30 do not identify with any religion. From a purely psychological point of view, this is not a good trend. Nihilism, the belief in nothing, is a rich fertilizer for anxiety and depression. In contrast, the belief in God, a guardian figure who loves us, is an invaluable source of support and comfort. I am often asked by parents, how do I talk to my child about death if I don't believe in God or heaven? My answer is always the same. Fake it. There are many things you don't tell your children the full truth about. For instance, if your children hear about a tragedy that has occurred in your community, you tell them that it will never happen to them. We don't have a crystal ball and cannot know that bad things will not happen to our children. Yet we reassure them with a hopeful narrative. The same applies to believing in God and heaven. Even if you believe that when your life ends, your bones turn to dust and you are gone for eternity, such beliefs don't help children. They only scare them and create anxiety over death and dying. Belief in a benevolent God and a heaven does help children with their fear. In our current age of broken families, distracted parents, school violence, and nightmarish global warming predictions, imagination plays a big part in children's ability to cope. It is far better for kids to use their imagination constructing something positive, such as a God who cares about us, than the dark nihilistic idea that there's no creator and protector and no purpose to our existence. I am also frequently asked how parents can instill gratitude and empathy in their children. Again, the best answer is involvement in an organized religion. All traditional faiths encourage gratitude and empathy as antidotes to entitlement and selfishness. These are the building blocks of strong character. They also protect against depression and anxiety. Additionally, religion provides children a chance for community. Being with people who share their faith can act as a buffer against the emptiness and isolation of modern culture. This is more necessary than ever in a world where teens can have hundreds of virtual friends and few real ones. And religion helps teach children mindfulness, a sense of self-control and discipline. Your young children might not be aware they are entering a house of worship, but they do know they're supposed to act in an appropriate manner when they are there. They have to relax their bodies and calm their minds. It is true that if you feel ambivalent about God and religion, your children will likely follow your example. However, if you practice religion or send your children to religious school, knowing it is good for them, you might surprise yourself and get something meaningful out of it too. In other words, your children may bring you back to faith. It's certainly worth an extended experiment for their sake and for yours. Consider one more argument. If you take the idea seriously that your children should be free to choose or reject God and religion, they need to be exposed to God and religion. How else will they be able to make a free and informed choice? We live in a competitive, stressful society that idealizes materialism, selfishness, and virtual rather than real human connection. Having a religious community and a belief in God is the best antidote to all of that. Whether children choose to continue to practice as adults is something you cannot control, but at least give them a chance to believe in God and find comfort in religion. They deserve it. I'm Erica Komisar, psychoanalyst and author of Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling, Raising Resilient Adolescents in the New Age of Anxiety, for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
Imagine wearing a t-shirt, or displaying a poster, or waving a flag, emblazoned with the face of a brutal killer who openly expressed racist anger at Blacks and Indigenous people, and undisguised disgust for gays. Well, it's not something you have to imagine. It's done every day. Somewhere on a college campus or at a social justice protest, somebody is celebrating a psychopath. The famous face, of course, belongs to Ernesto Che Guevara. It's one of the most perverse jokes in modern life that so many people, especially young people, exalt him as a hero. Strange hero. He personally murdered or had murdered and personally tortured or had tortured thousands of Cuban citizens. He would have happily murdered and tortured many more if he had lived longer. The only thing that stopped him was a bullet. He was killed in 1967 at the age of 39 trying to organize a communist revolution in Bolivia. They say only the good die young. Che was an exception. But Che still captures the popular imagination. Why? Hell if I know. Unless you're into sadistic thug worship, I am at a loss. Maybe it's as simple as this. People don't really know anything about what Che actually did, only what they think he did. They think he was a handsome, sexy, hip, brainy revolutionary who sought freedom and equality for his people, a Hispanic Robin Hood, a martyr who sacrificed himself for others. In short, a tragic symbol of righteous rebellion. Except this is nonsense. The real Che was a murderous, homophobic, racist hypocrite. Yet Che flags are a feature at Black Lives Matter protests. Go figure. Here is Che on race. The Black is indolent and a dreamer, spending his meager wage on frivolity or drink. Che explicitly stated that his vision of socialist utopia did not include Blacks. "We're going to do for Blacks exactly what Blacks did for the revolution," he said, by which I mean nothing. Or how about this? The Blacks, those magnificent examples of the African race who have maintained their racial purity thanks to their lack of an affinity with bathing. If you want to cancel George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, what do you do with Che? The answer is, you give him a pass. As the saying goes from the French Revolution, there are no enemies to the left. We see a similar confusion among the LGBTQ crowd. Che's face decorates many a pride poster and a rainbow t-shirt, and yet Che was an unapologetic homophobe. He called gay men perverts. He locked them up in camps and forced them to labor under a sign that read, "Work will make you men." In 2017, HuffPost published an article titled, "Are you gay? Che Guevara would have sent you to a concentration camp." The crusading humanitarian is not exactly checking the intersectional boxes, is he? Like a good Marxist, he claimed to despise luxuries and creature comforts, yet his Havana home was a vast mansion with a swimming pool, 7 bathrooms, a sauna, a massage room, a private yacht harbor, and 5 TVs. Not exactly an anti-materialist setup. Of course, he acquired this modest abode not by working for it, but at the end of a gun. In short, he stole it. This, according to professor of political science Paul Kengor, is a perfect summation of communism in practice. The revolutionary leader has the bourgeois enemy of the state dispatched, appropriates his property in the name of the worker, and then claims it for himself. But of the things Che was, most of all, he was a liar. He lied about everything. He lied about being a doctor. He wasn't. There is no record that he ever graduated from medical school. He lied about being a military genius. He wasn't. He botched just about every military operation he ever led. He lied about knowing how to manage an economy. In fact, he trashed a growing Cuban economy during his brief span as Ministry of Industries. People have long forgotten that Cuba in the 1950s, before Fidel and Che took over, was one of the strongest economies in Latin America. According to a 1957 UN report, the average wage for an 8-hour day in Cuba is higher than for workers in Belgium, Denmark, France, and Germany. What may be worse than Che's endless lies about himself is that so many people lied for him. I'm talking about the left-leaning journalists, academics, and A-list Hollywood stars and directors. They are the ones who built up, marketed, and have perpetuated the constellation of falsehoods that surround the hate-filled revolutionary. Why did they do it? One simple reason. Because Che personifies anti-Americanism, hatred for the United States. That's what the Che obsession is really all about. So if you hate America, I guess Che is as good a symbol as any. But that says as much about you as it does about the psychopath you're celebrating. I'm Gloria Alvarez for Prager University.
He's an economist, a historian, a philosopher, and one of the greatest social theorists America has ever produced. In a career spanning 6 decades, he's published more than 40 books and written thousands of newspaper columns on topics ranging from economic history and political philosophy to social inequality, education, and race. His name is Thomas Sowell, and he might be the most important scholar you've never heard of. Born during the Great Depression in rural North Carolina, in a home with no electricity, Sowell was orphaned when he was just a toddler. Taken in by a distant relative, he grew up in New York City's Harlem neighborhood. An unruly teen, he was obviously intelligent and obviously full of anger. The latter initially overwhelmed the former. He dropped out of high school, left home at age 17, and lived in a shelter for homeless boys, where he kept a knife under his pillow at night for protection. The Marines saved him. It wasn't by choice. He was drafted during the Korean War. In the military, he gained habits of personal discipline and developed self-control. He taught pistol shooting and learned photography, which became a lifelong hobby. After leaving the Marines, he went to college on the GI Bill, eventually graduating from Harvard and doing additional studies at the University of Chicago under the guidance of the legendary economist Milton Friedman. He began his intellectual journey as a committed Marxist, but soon reached a life-altering conclusion. Marxism didn't work. After studying the effects of various government regulations, including minimum wage laws, he concluded that free markets were a far better alternative, particularly for disadvantaged groups. Many attempts at redistributing wealth, he later wrote, have ended up redistributing poverty. In the 1960s and 70s, Sowell taught economics at Amherst, Cornell, and UCLA, distinguishing himself as one of the country's top experts on economic history. Since 1980, he's been a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. It was around this time that Sowell turned his attention to social theory and political philosophy, writing books like Knowledge and Decisions and A Conflict of Visions, which many consider to be his best professional work. He also began writing more about racial controversies, which is why he's not as well known and appreciated today as he should be. Sowell has been a vocal critic of civil rights leaders and of liberalism's misguided efforts to help the black poor. His targets over the decades have included welfare programs, racial preferences, multiculturalism, and opposition to school choice. Sowell brings the same empirical approach to writing about social policy that he brings to writing about economics. His focus is on the facts and the evidence. The actual results of a policy matter much more to him than the good intentions of politicians and policymakers. This is perfectly captured in his concept of stage one thinking. Liberal politicians propose expensive policy solutions and never ask the only questions that really matter. What are the long-term costs and consequences? In other words, what happens beyond stage one? By the time these costs and consequences fully manifest themselves, and they're usually disastrous, the politicians who originally set the policies in motion are long gone. They've derived all the political benefit and paid none of the cost. In books like Race and Culture, Sowell has demonstrated racial preferences are counterproductive, that political power is not necessary to advance economically, and that racial discrimination cannot be used as a blanket explanation for disparities in employment, education, and income. He's also shown how a racial or ethnic group's self-development, acquiring certain attitudes and behaviors, has far more bearing on economic advancement than how a group is treated by society at large. The Chinese in Malaysia and the Jews in Eastern Europe are among many examples of minority groups who have risen economically despite being the targets of bias and discrimination. To those who use racism as an all-purpose explanation for racial inequality, Sowell's views have made him a pariah. Unable to counter his rigorous, evidence-based scholarship, left-leaning intellectuals, political activists, and mainstream media prefer to ignore him. That's why so many people today are aware of names like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ibram X. Kendi, and Cornel West, but not Thomas Sowell. To say that Sowell has not had the impact he should is not the same as saying he has not had a profound impact on the thinking of a vast number of people. A fan account on Twitter has more than 700,000 followers. Videos of him on YouTube have millions of views. Mention his name to any conservative, and you'll hear Sowell spoken of in reverential terms. Indeed, he matters today more than ever. That's because we're still debating topics he's written volumes about, like social justice, slavery reparations, and critical race theory. And Sowell matters because he's that rarest of species, a brave and honest intellectual. We need 100 more just like him. I'm Jason Riley, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of Maverick, a biography of Thomas Sowell, for Prager University.
The role of the prosecutor is to pursue justice. This primarily means enforcing the laws passed by the representatives of the people. Enforcement protects citizens from future crime, but also offers some measure of satisfaction to the victims of crime. This is the basis of civil society. But over the last several years, a growing number of American cities have elected prosecutors who are de-emphasizing enforcement. This is by design. These prosecutors openly vow to reform the criminal justice system by means of selective prosecution. Their motive, seemingly well-intentioned, is that criminals do better when they're not incarcerated, that many people who are in jail shouldn't be there because they don't present a danger to society. So what does this reform look like? Here are just a few examples. In Boston, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins has ceased prosecuting 15 different offense categories, including charges like trespassing, stealing less than $250, destruction of property, and drug possession with the intent to distribute. In Brooklyn, Eric Gonzalez has either refused to prosecute or has rerouted many gun offenders to pretrial diversion programs. In Los Angeles, George Gascon has actually prohibited prosecutors from speaking at parole hearings. This forces victims and their families to take on the burden of speaking in opposition to early releases. He has also ordered his prosecutors not to pursue sentencing enhancements enacted by elected representatives, including those for third strikes and gang-related offenses. In San Francisco, Chesa Boudin instituted a policy prohibiting prosecutors from seeking bail and heavily restricted their ability to ask for pretrial detention. This is not a fringe movement. In addition to the four cities just mentioned, St. Louis, Baltimore, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, Orlando, Portland, San Antonio, and others have taken the same route. In fact, more than 40 million Americans now live in cities with so-called progressive prosecutors. That's a lot of reform happening outside the institutions designed to make the law, state, county, and city legislatures. And that's concerning for a couple of reasons. First is that a single official shouldn't be able to sidestep the political process and decide what laws to enforce or not. But a second, larger, and more obvious concern is that these changes aren't making our cities safer. Based on the data, they seem to be making our cities less safe. Take, for example, George Gascon's ban on third strike sentencing. In 2007, economists studied the deterrent effects of California's three strikes law. What they found was a 17 to 20% reduction in the felony arrest rate among those with two strikes. That's a pretty big benefit to throw away on one man's say-so. How about the goal of sharply curtailing pretrial detention? The data out of jurisdictions like New York and Chicago tell us that increasing the number of pretrial defendants out on the street will most likely mean more crimes committed by that population, crimes local residents could certainly do without. One study of Chicago's bail reform concluded that after more generous release procedures were put in place, the number of pretrial defendants charged with committing new violent crimes increased by an estimated 33%. In New York, the share of violent felony arrests constituted by those out of jail either on reduced bail or released without bail while awaiting trial for previous crimes jumped by more than 27% in the first 9 months of 2020, the year New York State's bail reform went into effect, and that's compared to the same period in 2019. A few other stats are worth noting. Baltimore's progressive DA, Marilyn Mosby, took office in January of 2015. Between 2015 and 2020, Baltimore has averaged 111 more homicides annually than the six-year period before Mosby came into power. Chicago's Kim Fox took office in December of 2016. Under Fox, between 2017 and 2020, there were 90 more homicides annually than there were between 2013 and 2016, the four-year period before she took office. Larry Krasner was sworn in as Philadelphia's DA in January 2018. During the 3 years he's been in office, the city has seen 112 additional homicides annually compared to the three-year period before he took over. It would be unfair to say that the progressive DAs in these cities are entirely responsible for these increases. Why certain crimes rise and fall is complicated, but the data is alarming. We all want to see fewer people in prison, but only, common sense would seem to dictate, if they stop committing crime and become productive citizens. By all indications, this is not happening. If it were, you can bet we'd be hearing about it. In fact, crime is surging to levels not seen in decades. The victims, all too often, are the people who live or work in the very communities these reforms are meant to help. Reform doesn't necessarily mean better. It can often mean worse. In the case of progressive prosecutors, perhaps much worse. I'm Rafael Mengual, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
There are a lot of partisan political issues out there, but election integrity shouldn't be one of them. What could be more basic to the very concept of representative government than having citizens trust that an election, whether it be for president or dog catcher, was fairly won or fairly lost? Yet in the recent past, this issue has become very contentious. For purposes of our discussion here, let's put aside any feelings we might have regarding a specific election. Here's the conflict. One side is primarily concerned that all votes are legitimately cast. That is, each vote can be traced to the person voting. The other side is primarily concerned that as many people as possible have the opportunity to vote. Now, a very obvious question arises. Why are these two concerns incompatible? Well, the answer is they are not. We should be able to both verify voters and make it easy to vote at the same time. Yes, even in politics, it should be possible to walk and chew gum simultaneously. Let's look to see how Georgia, where there has been much controversy over voting, has addressed this issue. First concern, voter ID. The recent Georgia voter reform law requires voters to provide an ID to receive an absentee ballot. Since 2008, the state has required a voter to show a government-issued photo ID when he or she votes in person. To require the same level of security for absentee voting seems to make perfect sense. In fact, one wonders why this wasn't addressed sooner. There's simply no good evidence that possessing an ID presents a hardship to voting. Have you ever met anyone who didn't have an ID? Anyone? When a federal judge threw out the ACLU-led lawsuit against Georgia's in-person voter ID law, he noted that in 2 years of litigation, the challengers could not produce a single resident of the state unable to vote because of the new ID requirement. But wait, as they say in TV ads, there's more. The new law says you can satisfy the voter ID requirement with a copy of a current utility bill, bank statement, government check, paycheck, or other government document that shows the name and address of the would-be voter. It's worth noting that the language on voter IDs for absentee ballots is identical to the language in the federal Help America Vote Act of 2002, which passed the U.S. Senate by a vote of 92-2. The yes votes included then-Senator Joe Biden of Delaware. Let's move on to the second concern, making voting easy. The charge against Georgia's new voting law is that it prohibits voters from access to water while they wait in line. One has to admit that sounds harsh. But if we dig a little deeper, we find that like most other states, Georgia prohibits electioneering within 150 feet of a polling place or within 25 feet of any voters waiting in line to vote. The new law simply added that within such distances, no one can give, offer to give, or participate in the giving of any money or gift, including, but not limited to, food and drink to any elector. In other words, a candidate, his supporters, or an activist group can't show up at a polling place with a truckload of Happy Meals and start handing them out to voters standing in line. The clear intent here is to prevent operatives from any party from unduly influencing voters with money or gifts, including food and drink. The idea that Georgia is somehow doing something nefarious by preventing gift-giving at the polls is, to put it mildly, bizarre, especially considering that this is a standard practice, as it should be, in most other states, including New York and New Jersey. By the way, the law says it's okay for poll officials to make self-service water from an unattended receptacle available to an elector waiting in line. And of course, you can bring a bottle of water with you if you're worried that you're going to die of thirst waiting to vote. But wait, there's more. The state added additional weekend voting days for those who want to vote early. To call these reforms the new Jim Crow, as some have done, or an example of voter suppression is simply not true. In fact, it's so far from the truth, it makes one wonder about the accuser's motives. But more than anything, it is an insult to the people who really did suffer under restrictive voting laws of the past. But those days are long gone, and the numbers prove it. Georgia has seen record levels of voter registration and turnout in recent elections, including 2020. That includes blacks and Hispanics, and that's been the trend for a decade. Anybody who wants to vote can vote. Introducing a few safeguards to build confidence that only legal votes are cast and counted just seems to make common sense. So why all the controversy? I'm Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation for Prager University.
What do we do about the homeless? This is one of the most vexing public policy problems we face. If you live in a big city, especially on the West Coast, you literally face it every day. And every day, it seems to get worse. Why? Let's start with a couple facts. First, the word itself is misleading. Homelessness is not primarily a housing problem, it's a human problem. The primary drivers of homelessness are drug addiction and mental illness. According to data from UCLA's California Policy Lab, approximately 3/4 of people living in cars, tents, and on the streets suffer from serious mental illness, drug addiction, or both. Second, despite these conditions, the homeless actually make rational decisions about where they want to live. Not surprisingly, they move to the most permissive environment they can find. Make your city attractive for the homeless, and they'll beat a path to your doorway. The Venice Boulevard underpass on the border of Los Angeles and Culver City brings home this point. It's one of thousands of concrete structures in Los Angeles County, but there's a curious detail. The Los Angeles side is full of tents, and the Culver City side is empty. Why? Because the two cities have different public policies. Los Angeles has effectively decriminalized public camping and drug consumption, while Culver City enforces the law. This pattern, that the homeless go where the policy environment is the most permissive, can be seen up and down the West Coast. In San Francisco County, it's estimated that 30% of the homeless migrated there after becoming homeless somewhere else. In the city of Seattle, that number is 51%. The San Francisco Chronicle estimates that hundreds of homeless individuals move to the Bay Area each year because of the perception that it is a sanctuary for people who are unwilling to participate in programs designed to get them off and keep them off a life in the streets. At first glance, this would seem to make no sense. Why would an individual with no shelter or stable source of income move to one of the most expensive cities in the country? But in the world of the homeless, it makes perfect sense. That's because they operate under a different set of incentives than the average citizen. In a research survey of homeless migrants in Seattle, 15% said they came to access homeless services, 10% came for legal marijuana, and 16% were transients who were traveling or visiting when they decided to set up camp. But this dramatically understates the biggest draw of all, the de facto legalization of street camping, drug consumption, and property crime. As former Seattle Public Safety Advisor Scott Lindsay has shown, the city is now home to a large population of homeless, prolific offenders, people who commit property crimes to feed their addictions, but are rarely held accountable for those crimes by the criminal justice system. So, is ever-increasing homelessness our inevitable future? If our goal is to make life as attractive as possible for the homeless, the answer is yes. If our goal is to actually help the homeless, the answer is no. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner is a Democrat, but his approach to homelessness is a world apart from his counterparts in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. It is simply not acceptable for people to live on the streets. It is not good for them, and it is not good for the city, Turner has said. Houston's policy is a perfect example of what Turner calls a tough love approach. The city has built housing for the chronically homeless, formed a coalition of nonprofit partners, and lobbied the state government for more mental health and addiction services. At the same time, Turner has enforced a strict ban on public camping and promoted a citywide campaign to discourage citizens from giving money to panhandlers. The results are as instructive as they are stunning. Over the past 8 years, Houston has reduced its homeless population by 54%, while it has skyrocketed in West Coast cities. Different policies, different results. Where a Seattle politician opposes hosing down feces-covered sidewalks because hoses are racist, Houston fights in the courts for the right to clean up encampments. Where California progressives push for more drug injection sites and have decriminalized thefts under $950, Houston imposes consequences not only for theft, but for aggressive panhandling, window washing, and other street obstructions. As this Texas city has demonstrated, local leaders in cities of any size can meaningfully reduce homelessness through a strategy that mixes compassion with common sense enforcement. If cities stop allowing public encampments and open drug consumption and start prosecuting property crimes, they will have much more success redirecting the homeless away from a life of self-destruction and toward a life of hope through mental health treatment, drug rehab, and job training. That's what we all want, isn't it? So why don't we do it? I'm Christopher Rufo, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Prager University.
Everybody knows what happened on July 4th, 1776. America was born. But 3 days earlier, on July 1st, independence hung in the balance. There was a great case to be made not to secede from Great Britain. The colonists had no army, no navy, and almost no money. England had a lot of all three. It would have made perfect sense to bend to the will of the crown, pay some extra taxes, and call it a day. There were plenty of people in Philadelphia prepared to make that case. They could have easily prevailed, yet they didn't. They didn't because of the words of one man, John Adams. At a key moment in the congressional debate, when the forces against independence appeared to have the upper hand, Adams rose to his feet. Without notes and without any preparation, he made the case for independence. By the time he sat down, the case had been won. We don't have a transcript of what he said. If we did, Adams might rank even higher than he does now among the founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson said years later that the speech was so powerful in thought and expression that it moved us from our seats. Adams was, Jefferson said, our colossus on the floor. If Washington was the sword of the American Revolution, and Jefferson the pen, then Adams was its engine. Brilliant, demanding, meticulous, but often irascible, he was not an easy man to love. At some point in his life, he irritated, if not alienated, everyone with whom he worked. Yet these same people would invariably come to appreciate him. That included Washington and especially Jefferson, with whom he sometimes fought bitterly. Ironically, for all his cantankerousness, his marriage to Abigail Adams stands as one of the great love stories of American history. Their correspondence, spanning five decades, is a vibrant, living history of the nation's early years. Abigail frankly described her husband as short, thick, and fat. But what he lacked in good looks and physical stature, he made up in intellect, personal integrity, and clarity of thought. Born in 1735 near Boston, Adams relentlessly pushed himself to rise early, work hard, and live a moral life. He strove, in the language of the day, for a life of virtue over vice. He first came to public attention in 1765 when he issued a stirring rebuke of the much-hated Stamp Act. For the next 18 years, he fought unceasingly against British tyranny and for American liberty, dedicating his life, his fortune, and his sacred honor to the struggle. These were not idle words. In his 40s, by the time of the Revolution, he didn't fight in the war. Instead, he crossed the Atlantic four times on diplomatic missions, braving winter storms, diseases such as pneumonia and dysentery, and British warships. Capture would have meant summary execution. In Europe, as befit his character, he was all business. He helped Benjamin Franklin bring the French into the war on the American side, and he arranged critical loans from Dutch banks. When the war ended, it was Adams, along with Franklin and John Jay, who negotiated the treaty in which England officially recognized the new United States. For all these efforts, Adams was paid virtually nothing. But fortune was never his aim. Creating a new, better, freer country than the world had ever known was all that he cared about. As one delegate to the Continental Congress said, "The man to whom the country is most indebted for the great measure of independence is Mr. John Adams." Following the war, Adams served two terms as vice president under George Washington and then one term as the second president of the United States. Taking over for Washington was a thankless task. Everyone deferred to the great general. To put it mildly, Adams was not granted the same courtesy. Still, the new president was able to distinguish his time in high office with two significant achievements. One marked by something he did do, the other by something he did not do. What he did was convince the Congress to build a navy. Given the strong opposition to any kind of standing military, this was no mean feat. But Adams was adamant that the United States could not become a great nation without a great navy. He pushed through the legislation that made it possible. What he did not do was get the country involved in the war in Europe. France insisted that America join it in its fight against England. France had come to America's aid during the fight for independence, the French argued. Here was America's chance to repay the debt. Adams firmly declined. The infant nation was in no position to wage war for or against anyone. As the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence approached, a 91-year-old Adams was asked to provide a toast for the upcoming celebration. He offered two words, "Independence forever." It turned out to be his last public utterance. How fitting. I'm Brad Thompson, professor of political science at Clemson University and author of America's Revolutionary Mind for Prager University.
Pro sports has become woke sports, and that's a problem, not just for athletics, but for all of us. Sport has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers. It laughs in the face of all types of discrimination. Nelson Mandela spoke those words. The Nobel Peace Prize recipient understood the power of sports to bring disparate people together. There is no better example of this than the famous victory of South Africa's mixed-race team in the 1995 Rugby World Cup. Mandela's presentation of the winner's trophy to team captain Francois Pienaar stands as an iconic symbol of unity in post-apartheid South Africa. Sports have served as a powerful racial unifier in America as well. This is not new. It goes back decades. In 1936, the great black sprinter and long jumper Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals at the Berlin Olympics. In 1938, the great black boxer Joe Louis scored a first-round knockout over German heavyweight Max Schmeling. The Owens and Louis victories punctured Hitler's Aryan superiority myth, unified black and white Americans in pride and celebration, and established Owens and Louis as America's first black national heroes. Jesse Owens and Joe Louis laid the foundation for Brooklyn Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey's partnership with black baseball legend Jackie Robinson to integrate Major League Baseball in the late 1940s. That, in turn, inspired Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and the civil rights movement of the 1950s. Barack Obama credited Robinson for his political rise. "There's a direct line between Jackie Robinson and me standing here," said America's first black president. Obama saw what Mandela saw, how sports transcends all barriers. When you see this group of folks of different shades coming from different communities and then playing as one team and celebrating each other and being joyous in that, that tells us something about America. Sports, in other words, is the ultimate equalizer. In competition, what matters is winning. That means excellence matters. And both are colorblind. Sports allow us to experience the power of pure meritocracy, the only way to govern sports and the only way to govern life. But now, all this storied history and the positive message of sports are being undone. In September 2016, NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick took a knee, that is, refused to stand, during the national anthem. His defenders say his protest wasn't about the flag, but Kaepernick said otherwise. "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color," he told the press. We all know what happened next. Players across the NFL followed Kaepernick's lead, kneeling, locking arms, and even raising fists during the national anthem. Then athletes from other sports joined in. Ironically, just as sports has the power to unite, we have discovered it also has equal power to divide. On opening day 2021, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred stripped Atlanta of the All-Star game as punishment for Georgia politicians' passage of a voter integrity bill. Bowing to the political mob that cast half of America's races, the move fractured baseball's fan base. The entire American sports world, a culture that celebrated victors, colorblindness, and patriotism, has immersed itself in victimization and left-wing radicalism. This immersion threatens permanent damage both to American sports and to the larger American culture. Once again, Kaepernick takes the lead. He no longer plays football. He is now a professional influencer. He hawks his political message in partnership with Nike, the $40 billion a year puppet master of American sports. Kaepernick, LeBron James, and Nike's other brand influencers are making millions off amplifying racial wounds. It's a cynical and brilliant business strategy. It explains why pro sports, especially the National Basketball Association, seem more concerned about how they are perceived in China than they are here in America. China is a huge market. Its 1.4 billion citizens have more sneaker spending power than America's 333 million. It's simple math. The $8 billion a year NBA is the marketing arm of Nike's $40 billion a year global business. To state it plainly, Nike is driving American sports. That's why team owners, coaches, and players are so willing to call America racist but remain silent on China's egregious treatment of its minorities and suppression of freedom in Hong Kong. Ultimately, the fans hold the power. They buy the tickets, the shoes, and the merchandise. Watch what they do. If they accept sports as just another arena to fight political battles, you'll know dark days are ahead. If they reject it, we'll be headed back to a brighter future. I'm Jason Whitlock for Prager University.
America is sick, and getting sicker by the moment. Is it any wonder, then, that healthcare costs continue to surge out of control, outpacing every other sector of the economy? Starbucks pays more for healthcare than it does for coffee beans. General Motors pays more for healthcare than it does for steel. 17 cents of every dollar spent in the U.S. goes to healthcare. That's 1/6 of all spending. 48% of all federal spending is related to healthcare. Not surprisingly, as of 2018, healthcare became the biggest business in the country. And the killer, literally, is that we're not getting healthier. Why is that? Complex question. But we can boil it down to two things. One, we don't pay enough attention to our own health. Strange, our health is our greatest asset, and yet we often abuse it. We eat food that doesn't nourish, avoid basic exercise, and ignore sleep. Two, we doctors don't pay enough attention to basic patient needs. The healthcare system rewards us for doing things to people, not for people. The result? A very expensive system to treat the most obese, medicated, comorbid population in the world. Let's look at these problems a little more closely. Obesity. According to data from the National Health and Nutrition Survey, 2 in 3 adults were considered to be overweight or obese. That was in 2014. This is a serious problem in and of itself. According to a CDC study of the COVID pandemic, 78% of hospitalizations were among those overweight or obese. Overmedicated. 10 years ago, we doctors prescribed 2.4 billion drugs. Last year, it was nearly 5 billion. Did disease really double in the last 10 years? No. It's just easier to push pills than to push real solutions. Comorbidity. Let's take type 2 diabetes as our example. It's been rising at an alarming rate, especially among young people. According to the CDC, new cases are increasing at a rate of 4.8% per year. This disease can lead to harmful and expensive complications like heart attacks, kidney dialysis, and even amputations. Two groups are unhappy with how we treat these conditions: patients and doctors. Surveys show rising levels of patient dissatisfaction with the medical care they're receiving, while other surveys reveal rising rates of physician burnout. So what does the future look like? More sickness? More procedures? And more pills at an ever-increasing cost? Well, if we keep doing the same things that we've been doing that haven't worked for the last 25 years, the answer is yes. But that's the very definition of insanity. We need to take a fresh approach. It will require the combined efforts of two groups, patients and doctors. The best way not to become a patient is to be healthy. Healthy people rarely need pills or expensive surgery. Over 75% of healthcare costs go to chronic diseases. As a doctor, I can tell you the hard part about chronic disease is not telling people what to do. It's helping them do it. That takes time. It's almost impossible to do in quick 10-minute office visits where doctors have to bill for everything they do. Again, the treatment of type 2 diabetes is an excellent example. It's a chronic disease for which people either take a medication or insulin injections. Yet most people with type 2 diabetes can come off their insulin simply by changing what they eat. When a disease can be cured by a lifestyle change, medication should be the last resort, not the first. This requires a partnership between doctor and patient. Both have to make a commitment to get to the underlying cause of disease rather than simply treat symptoms. Fortunately, there's a new wave of healthcare professionals who want to make this approach a reality. We're treating diabetes with cooking classes, not just insulin. We're treating more back pain with ice and stretching and physical therapy than just surgery alone. We're treating high blood pressure with healthy foods, yoga classes, stress management, and better sleep instead of just putting people on pills. I go into all of this in much more detail in my book, The Price We Pay: What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. America has the finest healthcare system in the world, the most skilled doctors, the most advanced diagnostic and surgical techniques. It's there if you need it. The trick is to reduce the odds that you will need it. That's not your doctor's responsibility. That's not the government's responsibility. That's yours. We can have great healthcare, be healthy, and save billions of dollars. They're not mutually exclusive. It will take two groups to get it done, patients and doctors. I'm Dr. Marty McCary, professor of surgery and health policy at Johns Hopkins University for Prager University.
Are fathers necessary? For all of recorded history, the need to explain why fathers are necessary would have been regarded as, well, unnecessary. It would have been like explaining why water or air is necessary. But we live at a time in which the obvious is routinely denied. There have been articles in the most prestigious journals denying the importance of fathers. The Atlantic magazine, for example, published an article titled, "Are Fathers Necessary? A Paternal Contribution May Not Be as Essential as We Think." The New York Times published a discussion among five intellectuals titled, "What Are Fathers For?" One of them, Hannah Rosen, an editor at New York Magazine, opened her response by stating, "I'm not sure whether a child needs a father." I could give dozens of such examples. I'll just give one more. HuffPost published a piece titled, "Fathers Are Not Needed." Fortunately, this dismissal of the importance of fathers is not universal. In a 2008 Father's Day speech a few months before his election as President of the United States, Barack Obama said, "Fathers are critical to the foundation of each family. That they are teachers and coaches, they are mentors and role models, they are examples of success, and they are the men who constantly push us toward it." What makes his comments particularly noteworthy is that Barack Obama grew up without a father. Both boys and girls need fathers. We'll begin with boys. A boy has no built-in understanding about how to be a man, meaning a good and responsible man. Male nature is wild, most obviously regarding sex and violence. If a boy does not have a father who models how a man controls himself, he will most likely not know how to control himself, let alone want to. That's why most males in prison for violent crimes grew up without a father. After days of riots in the UK in 2011, quite like the 2020 riots in America, Christina Adone wrote a column for the London Telegraph, whose title says it all. "London Riots, Absent Fathers Have a Lot to Answer For." In the column, she wrote, "The majority of rioters are gang members. Like the overwhelming majority of youth offenders behind bars, these gang members have one thing in common: no father at home." There's no question that many mothers have done an excellent job raising a boy without their son's father, but common sense alone suggests that a mother simply cannot model what a boy should be any more than a man can model to a girl what a woman should be. And then there is the issue of controlling boys and their wild natures. Again, there are mothers who are able to do this, but if a boy is at all difficult, as so many are, as he gets older, most mothers will find it more and more difficult to control their son, because unruly boys listen to their fathers much more than they listen to their mothers, which is precisely why most violent criminals grew up in fatherless homes. They obviously did not listen to their mothers. As regards daughters, the father is the man girls learn to relate to. Without a father to relate to and bond with, there are at least two destructive consequences. First, she will not know how to choose a man wisely. She will not know how a man should treat her, and she may well end up with a man who mistreats her. Second, to fulfill her desire to bond with a man, as primal a yearning in most women as bonding with a woman is in most men, she will go from man to man. Girls without fathers in their lives are far more likely to be sexually promiscuous and to begin sexual activity at an earlier age, which in turn are reasons many young women are depressed. Few women find sleeping with man after man fulfilling. Most find it ultimately depressing. Finally, fathers give both sons and daughters the thing children need most: a sense of safety and security. As much as children need love, they need a sense of security even more. And in general, moms give love and dads give security. I learned how necessary fathers are, not only by having one and being one, but by the many people, men and women, of all ages, who have told me that they see me as a father figure. I am honored to fill that role. The good news is that many men can fill it. Grandfathers, uncles, teachers, mentors, clergy, and yes, even a man on the radio. But some man has to be your father. I'm Dennis Prager.
This video is made possible by a generous donation from the Coutinho family.
Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.